right? And what was her sister? A princess! The Wicked Witch of the East, bro!
I'm gonna stab him.
You're gonna look at me and you're gonna tell me that I'm wrong? Am I wrong? She wore a crown and she came down in a bubble, dog!
I'm not fighting with you.
Grow up!
I'm not fighting
bro.
With you.
Everything grow is up.
Get educated!
This is a praise course, a frustratingly comprehensive emo podcast. We're much like Reddit, our opinion is law and nothing else matters. I'm Talisa, and everyone I know has made up a theory that I have scurvy this week, and I cannot stop them no matter how hard I try.
I'm James, and when the tallest girl in high school falls for a handsome foreign exchange student, she becomes embroiled in a surprising love triangle and realizes she's far more than her insecurities about her height have led her to believe.
I'm Alex, and yeah, I'm emo. Who fucking cares?
And let me introduce our guest this week, Music Goblin, former podcast host for Ask a Punk, drawer of bands badly on bands poorly drawn, booker of shows, America's favorite intern, and my vocal coach from time to time, Sierra Shuhai.
Hello.
Sierra has a very extensive past. A lot of things, a laundry list. Do you want to go over any of them in particular?
Starting from what?
Literally any of your, like, 20 bullet points.
Okay, well, I was very involved with emo Tumblr.
From a young age.
From a young age.
What is a young age?
Okay, so I'm 21. And I was very on emo Tumblr when I was, like, 14 to 17. So is
emo Tumblr, like, maroon basement hoodies and, like, pictures of Title Fight vinyl? Or what is that? Because that's what it was like when I was
emo
in high
Tumblr
school.
Where I met my fiancé?
Yeah.
Yes. That is a near unanimous yes if that is exactly where you met your fiancé.
Hard yes.
So, why did you get started on drawing bands badly on that Twitter account? That's where I know you from. I actually didn't know you started that. So why don't you give the audience here a little history about that project?
Okay, so the beginning of Bands Poorly Drawn's kind of hazy. I started it my senior year of high school, and I was just kind of bored, and I posted it on Tumblr. And someone was like, oh, that's funny. Draw some more. So I did.
Cool. That's probably how this podcast started, actually. Literally, Alex was like, yo, you know, it would be a good idea for a podcast if we talked about one popular emo song from each band. And then it became this.
This mousetrap board game.
And it just became, what if we just talked about any song?
So we're talking about quite a song today, but we kind of need to set this up with a little more musical theater background. Spoiler alert. So, Sierra, what's your Broadway experience like? What can you tell us and me about musical theater? Because I know next to nothing.
I would consider myself a casual Broadway and musical fan. I did musicals when I was younger, so I know a thing or two.
Sierra, I would say casual is an understatement.
I'm not like a stan.
I would say that High School Musical counts as a musical, and you one time threw your phone across my living room because Bet on It was playing.
Okay, but to be fair...
But that's not, like, Broadway.
To be fair, Bet on It is extremely emotional. Also, I have strong opinions on High School Musical 2, in that it does not take place in a high school. It should not be called that.
Well, is it supposed to be called Country Club Musical?
Yes, it should be called Country Club Musical. Or it should be called High School Musical
Golf
2.
Golf Course?
Subtitle, Country Club Musical.
Or High School Musical 2, subtitle, Summer Vacation.
That would be the easiest way to title it, but none of these things were chosen, they just put a big 2 on it.
I mean, they didn't subtitle Toy Story 4 the bad one, so I mean, they might not care about that.
I still have never seen Toy Story 4. Like, I'm not gonna buy it.
No, Toy Story ended with Toy Story 3, and that's fine with me.
Yeah, I cried little baby tears, it's fine.
I've never even seen 3.
It's good.
Oh, 3's really good.
Yeah.
I mean, 3 is also kind of a rehash of 2.
Yeah, but Andy's grown.
2 is a rehash of 1. I mean, we're going to get
really, how many ideas are we going to have with toys that talk?
Speaking of ideas, let's talk about Tall Girl for a second, because I feel that we glossed over that in the intro, and I think... Talisa, you've seen it, right?
Yeah, no. Katie made me watch it this week. Do you want me to give, like, a very brief plot summary?
Yeah, I did it in my intro, but I want to hear you do it, because I think...
My rehashing of it. So, yeah. There's a girl, and in the promos for this, they state that she is 73 inches tall, which, if you convert to the American feet standard, is 6'1", which is... tall, but not, like, I'm 5'11", that's only 2 inches on me, so I feel like it's not actually that tall.
Okay, but how tall were you in high school?
I was 5'9 as a freshman, and then I became 5'11 in sophomore year. And in the movie, she's, like, 17, so she's either a sophomore or a junior.
Yeah, I think she's near the end of high school. Because the way that the movie is set up is, like, she's been with these kids forever. And there's a bit in the movie where she's in middle school giving a presentation on who she wants to be when she grows up. And she says, I want to be like Taylor Swift. And then someone says, Taylor Swift? More like Taller Swift. And
oh, yeah.
Isn't Taylor Swift tall?
Taylor Swift
is tall. She's, like, 5'10".
Yeah, like, that totally misses the point.
Part of my thing is that the jokes, it's like a movie that if it didn't have the production quality of Netflix, it would be as laughably bad as something like The Room. But it does have that production quality, so it's not laughably bad.
We should stage an off-Broadway production of Tall Girl.
I could play the Tall Girl. Also, my favorite part of the entire movie. So, as I stated... I'm 5'11". I have a size 10.5 foot, which if you convert that to like men's shoes is like 8 to 9. In the movie, guess what size shoe she has?
I think it's like 13, right?
It's 13 men's.
Oh my god.
Which is like...
That doesn't make sense.
Who wrote this movie?
A short person.
It's a lot. My thing is, as soon as I said that, I paused the movie and I just turned to Katie and I was like, that's a clown. Like, essentially, this movie is not about a tall girl. It's about a clown. Also, this is not a spoiler because it happens in the first 5 minutes. Her friend that she's gone to school with ever since she was in kindergarten... In the movie, he has a crush on her, and he is, like, shorter than her, but he's, like, 5'6", maybe. But, like, you can tell that they purposely shot this movie from certain angles, because she never quite looks like she's in the same, like, field, like, depth field as the rest of the characters.
Yeah, it's like how they film Lord of the Rings to make The Hobbits. It's very weird.
The writer of this movie does not have any other credits.
I can believe that.
But he did also write lyrics to a song on the soundtrack to the film Tall Girl called Tip Topper's Theme Song, based on America the Beautiful.
don't remember this part. I must have blacked out.
There's a part in the movie where I already forgot the main character's name, but she comes home from school and her dad invites over this exclusive club of tall adults called the Tip Toppers. Because he wants her to realize that it gets better and people find friends that are tall and socialize. I mean, he's a good dad. It was a weird misstep in his character development, but he brings these Tip Toppers into their home. She is kind of greeted by them and weirded out by it immediately. And they start their meeting by singing the Tip Toppers theme song, which is about, like, being taller than everyone, and it fucking sucks, and she is not happy because this is a movie about high school and hating your parents. The other thing about the tall girl is she's like an asshole. She's like not nice to her one friend. She's not nice to the guy who's like really like has a crush on her and has been like a good friend as well. Like, she's just upset that she's tall. I don't know, it's a weird movie.
Yeah, she's I have no sympathy for her. Also, that's not how bullying works. Short people get bullied more than tall people. That's just a fact.
All right, let's get off of tall girl. I feel like that's not on topic. I was telling Liz we were talking about tall girl, and she said that's not on topic. So for her sake and our listeners' sake, let's get back to Sierra. I feel like you haven't talked in a minute. Talisa, how did y'all meet?
Me and Sierra met in 2015.
The day before my birthday.
Oh my god, yeah. You weren't even 18. I was like barely... I wasn't barely 18, I was probably 19. You weren't even 18. It was Modern Baseball at Union Transfer, and it was at the end of the show. And you probably still had long hair. Like, very long hair. And I still was straightening my hair.
Character development.
Yes. And that was midway through my freshman year. And then we spent that whole summer just going hog.
Truly bowling.
Spent a lot of times in an apartment building that Sierra lived in at the time that I would then live in. And when I lived in it, we spent at least like 3 nights a week hanging out.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was watching shit on Netflix. A lot of it was Oh Hello, which is John Mulaney and Nick Kroll's best work.
About Broadway.
And then we would watch Broadway musicals. That's where I watched Chicago for the first time.
Yeah, I kind of forced you into watching any musical that I couldn't get other people to watch.
Which I still hate. And it was around this time that you started giving me vocal lessons.
Yeah.
Because I was not good at singing for recordings at all. So do you want to tell me about your vocal lessons?
Okay, so I started giving Talisa vocal lessons in order to help her sing less like someone that's in Blink-182.
Hey, what's wrong with that, though?
Nothing wrong with that.
And but, who did she sound like?
Just like kind of like... sort of like the parody of a pop punk singer.
That's fair. None of this.
So I taught Talisa some vocal warm ups, and how to use her diaphragm, and you know, things have been looking up ever since.
I can reach notes now, not all of them, but most of them.
Were the notes on a tall shelf previously?
Yes, the notes were on a very tall shelf. Even I was not tall girl enough. But yeah, that was the start of Sierra giving me vocal lessons, which leads very nicely to talking about musical theater in general, Broadway, which is part of the episode today, which is about, drumroll please, one Defying Gravity from the musical Wicked, released in 2003, well, first premiered, I guess is how you would phrase it for the theater. It was premiered in 2003. Composed by and lyrics written by Stephen Schwartz, who, upon doing research for this podcast, I found out also wrote like most of the songs in Pocahontas and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. and in the movie Prince of Egypt, which apparently is also hitting Broadway soon. And this very weird movie that Disney Channel had called Enchanted, which was just a parody of Disney princess movies. But, like, it was very weird. Did anybody else see this movie?
Yeah, Enchanted was Amy Adams, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this wasn't a Disney Channel movie. This was a feature film.
No, it was a feature released in theaters.
Yeah, I get this movie confused with Ella Enchanted, which has Anne Hathaway. It came out a few years before that. But I feel like Disney in like the mid-2000s was trying to be like meta with their movies because people were getting bored. And so they made this movie, which, I don't know. I feel like when they went back to traditional fairy tales with a modern twist, like Tangled and Frozen, like they captured audiences better that way. But Enchanted was fun. I mean, it's...
Speaking of Frozen, that's extremely related to the song we're talking about.
Yes!
Yes.
I've actually never seen Frozen.
It's not that good.
The most I've seen of Frozen is the Kingdom Hearts sequence in which they just reprint Let It Go, like frame for frame, except Goofy's there.
I hate that. Yes, it is incredibly related, because Elsa Frozen was played by Idina Menzel, or Adele Dazeem, if you're John Travolta at the Oscars, in whatever year that was. But Idina Menzel, I didn't realize that, like, her debut was the musical Rent. That was, like, when she first went on Broadway, and then, like, two musicals later was her debuting as, like, the premier character, or the premier, I don't know, the main performer for Elphaba, who's the Wicked Witch of the West.
The lead role and the soundtrack recording for Elphaba.
Yes. Thank you.
The version of Defying Gravity we're speaking of is the Kristen Chenoweth, Idina Menzel soundtrack
recording.
Yes,
the original soundtrack recording.
Not the weird dance remix that they did.
Yeah, that came out a few years later. Right. I asked about this today. The version we're talking about is, within the context of the musical, is the closer to Act One.
Yes.
Cool. Because it shows up again, it's like a reprise, if I'm not mistaken. So we're not talking about that.
No.
Right now, why don't we just talk about the musical itself?
Yeah.
Because this musical owns.
See, I've never seen it, so I feel like I'm at a disadvantage to a certain degree talking.
I've never seen it either. I'm just deeply familiar with, like, the recording.
Then, Sierra, how can you say you're not, like, a Broadway star?
Okay.
To be fair, this is a recording that, like, in the past couple of years, we've seen huge Broadway breakouts like Hamilton and then before that, Book of Mormon. Wicked is the precursor to those two. Wicked was a huge hit.
It was like the first big hit after Rent. And Rent was kind of like this industry-changing musical. And right after that was Wicked.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine that, you know, if I'm going to a Chicago performance of this with my parents at 12 years old and their lives seem to be changed. The only musical I'd seen before that was Jesus Christ Superstar, which it's not on the same level. I mean, it's not bad, but it definitely doesn't have stage direction or any sort of magic behind it. Although some people might say Jesus is magic. I digress. The point is, like, I feel like this was a cultural moment in the early 2000s that Hamilton has kind of become in the 2010s. But musical theater for a while, it seemed to just be Wicked and the occasional Lion King performance. Because I didn't live near New York when I was a kid, so my purview of musicals was basically what I read on the internet or heard from certain people in my classes. Like, there was always one, like, person who was really obsessed with theater and Broadway, and they would always bring up Wicked, like, whenever they could.
Yeah, I mean, growing up, like, 20 minutes out of New York City, I remember distinctly on, like, the New Jersey Turnpike or whatever, that there was a Wicked billboard pretty much for most of my childhood life. That there was one this one billboard in specific that I knew when I saw it when we were driving out of the tunnel back to my house. Like, whenever we saw it, I was like, oh yeah, we're back in New Jersey. And that's, like, that was my landmark for that for, like, 7 years, I would say.
Yeah, like, as someone who also grew up not too far from New York, like, one of the things I would do is, like, my sister and I, we'd go into Manhattan, you would go to Times Square, they have this big red booth where you can get same-day Broadway tickets for steep, steep discounts. Because, let's be honest, Broadway tickets don't sell that great. They're very expensive. It's a fairly elitist industry.
Oh, yeah. One time, day of, when I was in high school, my friend went, do you want to see Newsies tonight?
My sister and I, we did that. We saw Nick Jonas in How to Succeed in Business. Same day, great seats. But throughout, like, the late aughts, early tens, the shows that would never appear on the board were Wicked and Book of Mormon. But everything else, even the popular ones, even Nick Jonas on Broadway, you can still get same-day tickets.
God, I wonder how that was.
Oh, it ruled.
I have a friend.
It ruled.
Speaking of Broadway, I have a friend that saw American Idiot on Broadway.
Honestly, that sounds like it rules.
Several times.
No, yeah, no, no. She saw it 21 times.
So, see, that sounds like it rules. Also, if I want to see an emo rock musical, I want to see Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, the off-Broadway production that never made it to Broadway, because that seems like it owned.
Does it take the stance that Andrew Jackson fucking sucks?
Yeah, it super does, okay, I believe.
Good. So, question for the group. That's if good. You could see one musical based on American Idiot, which takes the music of Green Day and that story, what band or album would you like adapted to the stage?
I want a Mitski musical.
Oh,
a
Mitski musical would be cool.
That'd be so powerful.
I want a Menzingers musical, but I think that's because I'm from New Jersey.
It would be like the Billy Joel musical. It would be sick.
Wait, there's a Billy Joel musical?
Yeah, it's called Moving Out.
I think I would choose... I mean, I could go for the easy answer, and I could say My Chemical Romance, but that's much too easy. Even though I wouldn't want Black Parade, I would want the concept that's behind Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge.
Oh, that would be dope.
The concept behind that record is so fucking sick. For those not in the know, the concept, very, very loosely, is that two lovers go to hell, and, like, the entire, like, I would say, like, half the songs are kind of revolving around that. Like, they go to hell for, like, murder and shit. Like, it's, you know, very, very loose, but it's sick. That, or a Gaslight Anthem or Bruce Springsteen musical. Which is very similar, just working class New Jersey musical.
Yeah, it's on the same level as the Menzingers. I would like a musical rendition of Emo Tumblr, then, and it's called Touch My Butt and Buy Me Pizza, and basically it's...
Isn't it just Alex and JC's love story?
Why? Oh,
heavily
no.
Featuring the music of Petal.
Oh no. Oh, no.
Well, my serious answer was actually Infinity on High. I think you could turn that into a musical, no problem.
The worst pre-hiatus Fall Out Boy record?
Are you fucking serious? You want to do this right now? That's their
yes,
best record
Yes, it is the worst
pre-hiatus
Fall Out Boy record.
I will die on that hill.
I agree
That's
with Alex
That's the best
Fall
Out Boy record. Y'all are funny.
What?
Foley
does exist.
Foley exists.
That is wildly incorrect.
There are so many takes happening here.
Hold on. I have a musical theater hot take. To get us back on track, musical theater and comic books are exactly the same. They're both, like, goofy, campy, like silly nonsense. But bros hate one of them for no reason.
Yeah, I feel like that's not, there's something else going on there. Like, there's a reason, it's just not a good one.
Yeah, the reason's called misogyny.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, it is true. I mean, I think with Marvel movies in particular, it is very overly dramatic a lot of the times for just the sake of being dramatic, which I think musicals, and this is a criticism that's been levied at Wicked by Vulture, is that it's just a hair bit overdone, which I think that's just the genre of musicals.
Yeah, and that's what makes them rule.
Yeah. Yeah, that's every musical.
So, like, by the same token, that's what a superhero movie is. You don't go into a superhero movie and get, like a straightforward film experience. You get something that's so fucking over the top every time.
Yes, and that's why they rule, and that's why comic books rule.
I mean, points remain.
So, let's talk about the material that makes up Wicked for a second, because this is obviously based on a book called Wicked, which is, in turn, an alternate retelling of The Wizard of Oz. Why do you think this works so
much? Which, I guess it's been public domain, right? I didn't think of that till today.
It must be.
Wizard of Oz characters have to be in public domain for this, right? It must be,
because the movie came out in 1937 or 39, like... really early on, you know, that's probably almost right. In public domain.
But the book is 1900.
Yeah, that must be in the public domain. At least the characters or the places or the names or something, so you could reuse them. But I don't know. Like, I always wonder why the biggest hits of the musical theater genre, like Alexander Hamilton is a hot topic of Hamilton. Like, no one pays attention in history class, at least no one did when I was in school, so it's just interesting that these kind of recastings of, you know, tired or somewhat boring things that people seem to think are boring get recast in the musical light and they're popping off. So why do you think The Wizard of Oz works? Counterpoint, Book of Mormon. What's up?
Counterpoint, Book of Mormon.
That's true. But why do you think that works? Why do you think that you can take something that's relatively tame, turn it into a musical, and all of a sudden it's a cultural sensation? And why do you think it happened with Wicked?
Wicked's super interesting. You could say it's Wicked interesting. Like,
you could. I'm not gonna.
You could say that. I mean, it's this, like, the book is a lot darker. So we're gonna just leave the book. Behind. We'll toss that aside. But two, it like tackles much bigger themes than the actual Wizard of Oz does. Wizard of Oz is really just this cute romp. Whereas, like Wicked, what I have in the notes here is Elphaba said fuck racism. Like, this is taking on much broader themes like discriminating against someone for the color of their skin, not just discussing the content of their character. Or like, there's a whole plot in the musical where animal people are being oppressed because they're animals, but Elphaba is the only one who speaks up and says furry rights.
Stop with the furries!
I mean, that is a good way of putting it. I know, you know, the term furry probably didn't exist in mainstream culture in 2003, but I remember watching this when I was 12 and really feeling that it was greater than the sum of its parts. I feel like a good adaptation of a book or a movie, not an adaptation of a movie, but an adaptation of a work is greater and comes away stronger if the themes in it speak to the human experience more broadly and more deeply than where it came from. And I think, like you said, I think The Wizard of Oz is pretty dark. But Wicked, definitely the book. I picked it up on a lark in the library once, and I immediately was like, oh, shit, I probably shouldn't be reading this. I kind of narked on myself with that one, but whatever.
Oh, my mom gave me her copy of Wicked to read, so...
Is that why you're the way you are?
There's a lot of reasons I'm the way I am. I was dropped on my head at less than a day old.
Wait, are you serious?
100%.
I'm sorry?
Well, let's not make you relive that. But I'm sorry. You turned out okay.
It's fine. My mom... I'm fine. I'm chilling.
Are you?
I'm fine. I'm chilling.
All right.
But more importantly, I think one of the interesting things about Wicked is that I think the point it's trying to make in recasting The Wizard of Oz is that good and evil is a lot more gray than people would like to believe. There's like a lot of true evil, like really callous, really heinous things. But like... A lot of that is in the eye, like, a lot of, like, minor evils are in the eye of the beholder.
So, why don't we talk about the plot of Wicked? I feel like you have the keenest grasp on it. Most of us, I haven't seen it in, you know, about 15 years now, and Sierra and Talisa are kind of coming into it with the soundtrack and not the playbill. So, maybe you could give the listeners and us a little bit of a rough synopsis, and then we can get into the song, which is kind of the crux of the argument in the show.
I will do my best. I have the Wikipedia page open to guide me anyway, but I also haven't seen it since 2007? No, 2010. So I'll do my best. In the Land of Oz... No, I'm not going to read Wikipedia verbatim. The gist is that Elphaba is born, as an illegitimate child, and for some reason she is green. That's weird. No one likes her because she's green. She fights with her sister, because her sister is the favorite.
Glenda?
No, the sister Nessa Rose.
Okay. Her and Glinda are friends.
Her and Glinda don't start friends, though. No. That's the thing. Oh, Nessa Rose and Glinda are friends?
Hmm?
Who and Glinda are friends?
Oh, never mind. We're not there yet. Keep going.
Here, okay. Alex, let's do this. Read Wikipedia, because I feel like that's just easier. And I'll just...
Wikipedia is very long.
Wikipedia is long. It's very long.
It's a whole play, okay. James.
Well.
From what I can...
Okay, I understand what's happening.
But can I...
Sierra,
well, I
you're
can
reading
ascertain...
the synopsis in order. And I'm, like, skipping from the beginning of the story. You're starting from the beginning of the play, not the beginning of the story.
Okay.
I'm starting from the beginning of the story, not the beginning of the play.
All right.
Sorry. We're on the same page now.
Okay. Go on.
Okay. Yes. So Nessa Rose is the favorite. Elphaba grows up sad and not liked. Boy, there's a lot of other stuff going on.
Can I give, like, my brief bullet points for what I can ascertain?
Yes.
Basically, Elphaba is born, a bastard. And since she is born illegitimately and looking different and all this way, the community as a whole rejects her, and her sisters help play into that rejection to a certain degree. From what I can understand throughout the play, Glinda is not necessarily like the evil character. She tries to relate to Elphaba, which you can even see in Defying Gravity, that like she doesn't necessarily want to push her away but can't like fully be with her all the time as far as like mental wavelengths go.
Glinda's just got too much privilege.
Exactly. She doesn't want to, like, risk her status by supporting her sister that is heavily disliked. So the community hates her, are racist, as we've mentioned before. And then later on, she finds out about all the things that Oz is doing. And she obviously, like, she's not chill with that because she knows what it's like to be persecuted. And she doesn't like that Oz is fucking attacking these animal people. Furries. So she wants to, like, fight against this, but obviously the community sees him as this great guy. But she does not. So she kind of breaks away. And that's, like, most of the play, I feel.
Would you say that she's defying gravity the whole time?
I mean...
She's not being held down.
No.
I love the Wizard of Oz being this kind of stand-in for idol worship. I feel like that is a timeless thing that has totally not been shattered in the 80 years that this has been a property. I like that Wicked turns it on its head a little bit and becomes, you know, an act of defiance to not give in to that. I wish that was true for real life, but alas, none of us are in Oz. So, okay, I think that was a pretty good synopsis, y'all. You did a great job, Talisa. So, round of applause.
Yeah, we did skip over where she comes down in a bubble, Doug.
She came down in a bubble, dog.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. God. We could drop that in, probably.
That video is as much a part of American culture as the premiere of Wicked in 2003 was.
I would say that.
I hear no disagreements.
You're not going to get a disagreement from me.
Here's something that we can agree on. We are in time for an ad break. So we have our backstory, we have our summary. It's time to take off and fly high into this song and come down in a bubble. But first, a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back after this.
We are back here on a praise course. And Talisa, James, and Alex are with me as always. And Sierra is here providing her extensive Broadway knowledge. We just went over the whole musical of Wicked, but we need to take a deeper dive into the particular song that I feel like is the most important part of the phenomenon that was Wicked, which was the iconic Defying Gravity, a hit with every talent show middle school girl that thought she could sing. Which, it is not an easy song to sing.
Yeah, it's wicked hard.
All right, that's two. We get one more of those.
Like, total or just us? We each get three.
For the pod.
Ooh.
Okay.
That's good. I think
use it wisely.
That keeps us good. That keeps the jokes good. But let's keep this good. I do want to read this. I copied this from the internet. Just to give everyone a little orientation of where we are in the plot when Defying Gravity drops to close out Act 1. So, in Wicked, the song is the finale for the show's first act, when Alphaba discovers that the Wizard of Oz is not the heroic figure that she originally believed him to be. Realizing this, and despite Glinda's attempts to dissuade her, Alphaba vows to do everything in her power to fight the wizard and his sinister plans against the animals of Oz. She sings of how she wants to live without limits, going against the rules that others have set for her. During the song, Alphaba enchants a broomstick to levitate and, pursued by the wizard's guards, rises from the stage above the angered citizens of Oz, who try in vain to bring her down. The song is heavily cinematic and comes to a climax for the final verse. The staging of this climax features several special effects. The actress playing Alphaba is lifted up into the air by a hydraulic launch system. The sequence relies heavily on around 60 moving lights, smoke, and wind effects.
As someone who did stage crew in high school, I love the emphasis on the stage crew here. Good work, stage crew.
As someone who did stage crew Now, this is impossible to read. Also, spoiler, later in the Wikipedia, where that is copy and pasted from, it is mentioned that for a lot of the shows, they would use, like, well, the system in general for all the shows was a cherry picker, and that would be what lifted the actress to fly. But for a lot of them, the cherry picker would break, and she would not defy gravity, and would be firmly on the ground during the highly climactic final verse, which, as they described it, led to a lot of funny performances.
It does at least defy viewer expectations.
I also did stage crew in high school, and I feel that this, when it breaks, it just, like, it ruins the whole magic of the event, but I feel like there's enough suspension of disbelief within Broadway theater where you can kind of just assume it's happening. I don't know. I feel like people have learned to ad-lib their way around certain mechanical and technical difficulties. So I don't know. It's funny, though, to see that this still happens. No matter how much money you have in a stage crew or production values, you still have these complete errors that change the whole vibe of the show.
Yeah. But I just think that that's, because the whole song is kind of a shit show, which we're going to get into right now.
A beautiful, beautiful shit show.
Oh, baby. Where to start?
Well, Sierra actually has, like, way more of a deeper understanding of musical composition than I do. But, like, I never really noticed this until, like, I read all these articles and, like, thought about it. The intervals in this song?
There's an 11-step interval.
Which is worse than the national anthem, I think.
Yeah.
Or right on par. Because notoriously, the national anthem is a poorly written song.
Any octave...
Okay. Pretend I don't know anything about musical theater.
Yeah.
Just pretend.
Okay, so an interval... An interval is the space between notes. A scale, like an octave, is 8.
Oh,
and
boy.
11 is more than 8. And that's just math.
That, I can, you know, I can't do music, but I can do math.
Exactly. So if it goes over 8, it's very, very hard to make that jump.
Because you have to go from... Like your chest voice to your head voice.
Yeah, which
in
is
most
just
cases.
That's just hard in general. And actually, if you look up like the non-recorded, like I looked up like a performance from like David Letterman or something, you can see Idina Menzel struggles heavily to sing this, and she is like the one that like has performed this part the most, probably.
Definitely the most iconic.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not like this part was written for her, but she's the one that made it famous. So you would think that since she was also the first singer of this, that they might, like, I don't know, change the notes?
Yeah, no offense to Stephanie J. Block, but when people think about this song, they think of Idina Menzel.
Oh, yeah. I don't even know who Stephanie J. Block is. All due respect to her.
I mean, I think... You know, obviously it's a batshit composition, the way that it's set up. You know, plenty of songs, even in, you know, the popular canon, have been written outside, like, a vocalist range, like Damn It by Blink-182. Mark Hoppus, like, wrote it out of its vocal range. It's not important. But the point is, I think it does set, like, a thematic example in the show where, like, she is... exceeding her own expectations, therefore the song has to kind of be out of bounds as well. And if we as an audience member to believe that she is having this character shift, the music kind of has to reflect that. Because I feel like as a body of work, Wicked, at least the score and the music, affects the narrative and the action more than the dialogue might. You know what I mean?
I would agree. I mean, here's the thing. Despite, because I never noticed until I read that it's a compositional shit show, which shows how powerful that song is to the common listener. And I think that a lot of the critiques for it are people just trying to be particularly nitpicky and pick on this thing that a lot of people like.
Yeah, until I listened to it like with a critical lens like earlier in prepping for this, I did not notice anything that would be like that I disliked. I love this song.
Can we all go around and say our favorite part of the song?
Yeah, let's do it.
I mean, me personally, it is very particularly the drums in the last verse.
Oh my god, the drums in this song are a disaster. They're a disaster! No, I'm listening to this song, that's what I was going to specifically say. I was thinking of when listening to this song today. They're a disaster. I love it so much.
How are they a disaster,
exactly,
Alex?
Because they're not in time with the singing.
Well, the entire thing is that the singing's not in time. Every single article is like, there's no fucking time signature.
I know. It's so wild.
But it's something I never noticed. I never noticed that Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel are never singing at the same pace. One. Two. Idina Menzel is not singing at the same pace for most of the song by herself. The only thing that I would say actually keeps to any sort of timing structure, as far as like time signature, is the bass line. Because I think that's the most like solid core that you have, and that the bass line's like following some time signature. And I like to imagine when they were like composing this that the bassist was like, what the fuck?
Well, I looked this up on Genius, because the beginning of the song, like, I don't know anything about music. I'm not, you know, I know nothing about time signatures and composition, but they say the beginning of the song up to where Glinda and Elphaba harmonize together, up to that point in the song, that whole part is in free time or a calle voce. So there's no time signature. So the band has to keep up with how the vocalists are going. And that's insane. Usually it's the other way around, right? You have a drummer or a rhythm section keeping the time and keeping the beat steady. So if they speed up, the vocalist or the guitarist or something speeds up as well. But this is the opposite. So it's fucked up by design.
Yeah, and it's not like they're playing a consistent line in that part. It's all, you know, sudden, like, bump, bump, like, exclamation points accentuating parts. Which I'm not sure. Personally, I would find that more difficult because I have to be like, all right, she's done talking. Like, this song is just, it's one of those things, again, I never noticed it.
Yeah, I don't think the typical Broadway goer is going to notice it either. And honestly, they didn't, because this song is the song from this show.
I think the reason people may have not noticed is because, think of it lyrically, right? Let's talk about the hook for a second, or the chorus, you know? It, you know, I think, like, it's such a positive message that's universal. The idea of being unlimited, or being the greatest team there's ever been, right? I'd sooner buy defying gravity, kiss me goodbye, I'm defying gravity, and you can't pull me down. That's relatable to anyone from a seventh grader getting bullied for the first time to a wine mom sharing minion memes on Facebook. It can't, like, there's no set target for who that song is relatable to. So it transcends its source material and becomes something that, you know, is infectious long after you leave the theater. You know, I think that's why. I don't think people are automatically thinking of how discordant the structure of this is. They're thinking about, okay, that's a cool thing that I can get down with.
I actually think the discordant structure helps reinforce the message of the song, though. Like, it's this message of, I can do anything I set my mind to. And so, of course I can do that to this song. That doesn't make any fucking sense.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it does help. I think that it's a very, I think that it not being like a typical Broadway song is also why it stood out. Because I feel like if it was like that typical format of how Broadway songs work, that it would not have stood out nearly as much against what other musicals were producing at the time and what audiences wanted from that song.
Well, I think the thing about it is that Wicked, again, fills such a specific cultural moment that most people have heard this song. The other thing, too, is like where it is in the musical, like you could explain that to anyone, or you could even just listen to the song and infer that that's like the showstopper moment. You know, most musicals have them, you know, either a closer or some sort of song that gets reprised later. But, you know, probably on Broadway night, this closed the show, or this is the one that everyone's holding their breath for a reason, because it is serving the same purpose that it did in Wicked, you know? And we could talk about this all day, but I think we should talk about why this is emotional, because I think we all have thoughts about that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So lay it on me, folks. Okay,
so this song is basically a World Is song.
Okay, what do you mean?
Me and Sierra went over this before about how we're going to tag team this. Have you ever heard the song January 10th, 2014?
Oh my god, this is January 10th, 2014.
Exactly.
Oh my god, it's the same song.
The crescendos, the drama, the storytelling.
So, for people who aren't obsessed with The World Is, like some of us are, let's talk about January 10th real quick. Like, why are you connecting the two? Besides the fact that the storytelling in that song is particularly poignant, is it because that song is also, like, musically, I would say, stitched together of very different parts? Like, it doesn't seem like a song that's organic. It just seems like a frenzy.
It has a lot of sonic elements in common, but, like, yes.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in general, The World Is a band. The World is a band that uses a lot of crescendos.
Dynamics
are very heavily used, which is a thing that's heavily used in The Fine Gravity. Powerful finales are like a part of a lot of the bigger songs that The World Is has, which Fine Gravity is one of the most powerful finales I've ever heard. And yeah, I mean, the storytelling, the going back and forth singing, and like, I wouldn't even say that either sounds stitched together, because like there is a certain flow between the parts for both songs. But yeah, I mean, there is a certain storytelling, or there is a certain thing that's stitched together for both songs. But I don't know, stitched together sounds like they're too disjointed from each other. Like, all the parts.
And I don't think they're disjointed. I think they're just, like, kind of movements within the songs.
I can't believe you're making me realize the reason The World is one of my favorite bands is because they're musical theater.
I think the thing, I saw a tweet from our friend Lex of Chatterbot Records fame, and she said, you either live long enough to be a theater kid, or wait. It's the Batman Dark Knight thing, and it's like, you either see yourself be a theater kid or live long enough to be involved in DIY music. And I think a lot of the tenets of musical theater, especially in high school, paid off into these bands that are making theatrical, very multi-layered, multi-instrumentalist works of art. I mean, The World Is has, like, you know, more than six members at any given time, right? So it's like taking the ensemble nature of a Broadway show or even you know, a stage play and putting it on a smaller stage, so to speak, but having the same grandeur. And I think that's sick.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can agree the World Is and Wicked, both sick. Both larger than life musical acts.
both make you feel like you drank a cup of coffee after you listen.
Hell yeah. So I do want to talk about this one thing that fucking Vulture likes to say. So Vulture did a top 10 list of the top 10 songs in Wicked for its anniversary. Defying Gravity was obviously on there. And I did mention this earlier, but I do want to say it again. They say it's a hair overblown, which I feel is an understatement for the sake of literary art, you know, to say it's a hair overblown. I mean, like, that's the point of it. You know, I think we've said that here is, like, Defying Gravity is the centerpiece of the show because it is bombastic. It's written outside the range of so many people that have performed it, I would say on purpose. It's a musical kind of nonconformity in general, as it is a lyrical nonconformity in what it represents for the show. But, like, saying Defying Gravity is overblown is like saying Blink-182 is just immature for writing songs about high school when they're 40. Like, duh, right? I don't know.
Yeah, it's like one of those things of it's like, okay, and so what? Nobody that likes Wicked is going to, like, not necessarily realize that it's overblown. And nobody that's listening to Blink-182 knows that, like, Mark Hoppus is being serious when he's, like, singing on... I mean, he's being serious to a degree, but he's not being super serious when he's singing Bored to Death.
Or blocking me on Twitter, but that's for a different episode. So, I think we've kind of covered the bases here. You know, we've talked about the origins of the show, the stage disaster, comparing it to a contemporary emo band in the normal emo canon. But to Lisa, I think it's time to add more stuff to the emo canon, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So to wrap up today, as we always do, this is today's chorus. So Sierra, I'll set this up for y'all. This literally can be anything. It doesn't have to be music. For the past couple weeks, Alex and I have really talked about video games or Simpsons episodes. Things that you think have an emotional center that can help us recontextualize what the word emo means without necessarily having to be music, like emo is. So, Talisa, do you want to start? And then, Sierra, you can finish this out.
Oh, boy, can I start. So what I am adding is a very particular episode from the TV show The Sopranos. It is the first episode from season 5. It is called Two Tonys. This is no spoiler for the series. I'm gonna keep this as spoiler free as I can get. But I mean, even from the first season, from the first episode, he has a crush on his therapist, Jennifer Melfi, Tony Soprano, we were talking about. And in season 5, I mean, as he does in many of the seasons, he makes yet another move on Melfi. And he says something that I am 99% sure has been sampled in an emo song. It sounds familiar. It's an audio clip I've definitely heard before. And he says to her, and he, like, holds her face tenderly. And generally, Tony Soprano is an emo character. He has anxiety. He goes to therapy. We stan a king that goes to therapy. Everyone should go to therapy if they can afford it. It's just good for you. But Tony Soprano, he says, I want your mouth. Oh, no, I want your skin. I want your mouth. I want your eyes. Which I'm pretty sure is a sample in a song, but I cannot find it. So this is half me editing Tony Soprano and that episode in particular to the emo canon. Just because it is, like... I mean, in general, it's a show that, like, stirs up a lot of emotions and has, you know, a lot that goes on. Particularly with the character, you know, Tony Soprano. Like, obviously he's the main character, so he's gonna get the most character development in the series. But... He's a generally, like, really good character. This is half me adding him in that episode to the canon. and half me speaking out into the universe that I need to find what song samples this, because I know I've heard it, but I just cannot fucking find it.
If I find it somehow, I'll drop it in here. But I was starting to watch The Sopranos with Liz, and then we got through episode one, and then watched I Think You Should Leave instead. So we're going to try that again, because I think, yeah, the whole therapy arc is very nice, because why would a mobster or a tough mafia guy go to therapy? It doesn't make sense on paper, but it makes for the most compelling thing that I can think of on television.
I mean, that's why season one is still one of my favorite seasons of TV, because I really don't get that into TV shows. The Sopranos is the first TV show I've liked this much. I have a Sopranos hockey jersey. When I refer to it, I refer to it by its full legal name, the Sopranos hockey jersey.
Where did you get that?
Because I... eBay? It was... So, when The Sopranos was on TV in the early 2000s, they released a bunch of merch items, which were sports jerseys from the regional teams, but outfitted to look like have the Sopranos logo on them and stuff. So there's this hockey jersey that they have where it's red, black and white, like the New Jersey Devils. But the logo on the front is just a Sopranos logo. And then on the side, it has like O1 on each shoulder as a number. And that's like the whole jersey. But it's like a pretty high quality jersey. And I got it for like $30 on eBay, which I feel like isn't that bad. And then they also have a football jersey that they made that's like the Giants colors, which is relevant because today they've benched Eli Manning. And then the baseball jersey that they made wasn't in any like color format for either of the New York teams, which is weird. It was just like a black baseball jersey with red trim. But yeah, they made a bunch of merch items. So that's where I got that, was eBay. Yeah, but I mean, season one I love because not the entirety of season one, but a lot of season one revolves around Tony figuring out, or Tony being ashamed of being in therapy and figuring out, does he want to deal with this shame? Does he want to tell people? How are people going to feel about it? Like, you know, normal stuff that a lot of people have when they're going into therapy, which I highly appreciate and didn't expect. Because I went to Sopranos thinking it was just going to be a mob TV show. And then I was like, oh, my man's has anxiety.
Yeah, the thing about The Sopranos that I like is kind of what I like about The Wire, is like The Wire is about like Baltimore gang members, but you know, you have an openly gay character who's like the toughest badass ever, but it adds like a nuance to his character that you wouldn't normally get if you went into it thinking it was just about, you know, violence and crime, you know. And I think TV in the 2000s especially created this layer where it was a lot more than it seemed, which is cool.
Speaking of The Wire, that's a great segue into my edition, which I have not informed either of you of.
Okay.
My edition is that moment on Twitter.com when somebody responds to a creator with a dumb comment.
Yeah, I think I saw what you're talking about.
Yes. David Simon, creator of The Wire, tweeted about the Joe Biden corn pop thing, saying that it's believable he's heard many stranger street names. And somebody responded, "Have you seen The Wire?" And it is the only good thing that ever happens on that website. It brings me so much joy to just watch someone do this to themselves. And it happens like once a week. It's so good. It's just mwah.
Yeah, the thing about people is that they are so confident, you know, that they're correct and that they're going to dunk with such ferocity that they're going to break the backboard, which is a segue into mine. We're really killing it in this last stretch here, but I don't know. I think, like, why would you go to head-to-head with any verified account? Like, you're going to lose. Normally. Especially...
Normally is the key phrase.
Yeah. But, I mean...
A good friend of ours went toe-to-toe with Halsey and won.
Did we ever figure out what happened there? Was,
Oh, I know the full story.
Okay. Do we want to save that, probably?
We can't. I think we should.
All right, let's save it, because I think it's a juicy podcast exclusive for when we bring them on the podcast, for sure. So I want to talk about dunking, specifically Shaq. I watched his Hot Ones yesterday, and he blew through his first million when he signed to the Orlando Magic by buying his parents the same car. So he had a million, so he went and he bought a Mercedes, and then he drove it home, and his dad asked, "Where's mine?" So Shaq went back to the dealership and bought his dad a Mercedes, and then his mom wanted one, so he bought her the little Mercedes, and then he just gave a bunch of money to friends, bought a nice watch, some suits, you know, living the light of the height of luxury, and then he gets a call from FICA, or the tax organization that taxes athletes. Turns out he only had $600,000, and then he was $50,000 in the hole from that initial million-dollar check. My point is, Shaq blew through his money so fast, he never did it again. He got a business manager, and he started to make smarter money decisions, and he's raised his six children the same way. And I think Shaq making a mistake early in his career and learning from it to become a mogul and an empire creator and one of the greatest athletes of all time is very emo. I think emo has a weird obsession with basketball, you know, Dikembe and all that. But, I mean, in our canon, I think we should bring over one of the greats, Shaq.
He's so great, he could never hit a free throw.
Yeah, it's another emo band, Free Throw. Anyway. So.
All right.
Sierra.
Sierra, what are you bringing to the table?
The stuffed animal section at IKEA.
Can I tell you, I almost brought IKEA to the table.
So why are you bringing stuffed animal section to the table, Sierra?
It was recently in my mind. I saw this tweet that said, "Me trying to save money. IKEA shark named Blahaj. Hi, I'm Blahaj." And all the comments were people with their IKEA sharks.
That's good. So, I mean, I saw that tweet too and laughed for a very long time.
I did not see this tweet.
It's like one of the best of the past week for sure.
It was
the
most wholesome.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't aware that IKEA had stuffed animals at all. So that was a nice education for me.
I think my favorite are the Bernese mountain dogs that they have.
Do you know the name of the mountain dog?
I don't.
They also have rats.
I don't like rats, but I do like this shark named Blahaj.
Oh, Blahaj is great.
I have a Blahaj, so hit close to home.
I think I need to go back to IKEA soon.
I'm going to use our third strike. I'm going to use a third strike real quick. What do IKEA sharks do when they go to Las Vegas?
What do they do?
They hit up the Blahaggio.
Oh.
That, I don't know.
I didn't like that.
I'm... And with that...
And with that, that was a praise chorus. It might be our last episode. Who knows? We are a frustratingly comprehensive emo podcast. Our theme song comes courtesy of Skatoo Network, who just announced their debut record of sorts called Pick It The Fuck Up via Counterintuitive Records. So congrats to them again. We congrats them last week. They seem to be killing it in literally everything. But Everything Else was built by Love by One of Us Three in Philadelphia, PA. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Praise Chorus, and be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts for any questions, concerns, or to get Mark Hoppus to unblock me on Twitter. Please email us at praisechoruspod@gmail.com. See you next time.
Just so you know, we have a Patreon. Head on over to apaidchor.us, and sign up for A Paid Chorus. It's basically the same comprehensive emo podcast, just with more. We've got bonus and ad-free episodes, a Discord server, and so much more, all starting at $1 a month.